Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World, a classic Doctor Who podcast that occasionally, such as events like Console Room, talks about the new series too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and occasionally not so great about our favorite show. And as I said, today we are at Console Room, so we're really excited, and we have two special guests.
Yes, you know what I like about today's panel, Joshua?
Yeah.
Is we have two returning guests.
So they should know how to do this.
I hope so.
I don't.
So who we have, for those of you listening at home who can't actually see the people in front of you, we have Christian Erickson, one half of the band The Seva Team, and Christopher Jones. I don't know much about you.
Here, I'm the other half of not the band Seva Team.
So, Christian, tell us a little bit about the band.
Yeah, we first met because I've been in a whole bunch of different bands, and a great many of them were bands that were obsessed with sci-fi, and specifically Doctor Who, and I've been in no less than three different bands that have written sort of Doctor Who-themed songs, and as we talked about the last time when I was here, my once ambitious idea to write a Doctor Who rock opera, which I actually wrote about a quarter of and never finished, and then you guys said you should finish that. So
it wasn't a hard sell.
We'll see. We'll see.
It's based on Caves of Andazani.
That's right. So it was based on your thing was, when you come on the show, you better be prepared to talk about your favorite episode. And I said, well, not only do I have a favorite episode, I was going to write a rock album about it. And I got a bunch of lyrics, and I think I even pitched some of the songs to you guys, and you seem to like it, so maybe I should continue that.
I think it's got legs.
Yeah, but anyway, so
would you guys see a rock opera based on Caves of Andazani? Yeah.
If you can make the Phantom of the Opera into a slightly crap musical, like you can.
I'm Chris, you have recently done a Doctor Who related comic book project.
Yeah,
plug that.
I've been drawing comics for many years, but I just did my first official Doctor Who project. I did a 5-issue miniseries featuring the Third Doctor for Titan Comics, and that was written by Paul Cornell, and it had all the trimmings you'd want to go with a Third Doctor story. We had Joe Grant and UNIT and the Roger Delgado Master and all that good stuff.
Is Bessie the car in it?
Oh gosh, yes. Okay. It ticked all the boxes. I was very happy.
Bessie was my favorite Doctor Who.
Yeah, the master used the tissue compression eliminator. Everything I wanted. It was all there.
Rubber masks. He
used absolutely.
Many rubber mask disguises. It's great.
In crazy ways that you never saw them used in the television show.
So for this episode, we are going to be talking about the first four episodes of Series 10.
What? And,
surprise, Pat.
That's not our brand.
I know.
We're going off brand here.
We're kind of curmudgeons about the new series often, but we love Peter Capaldi, and we wanted to do an episode that focused on Series 10, and we are going to spoil the heck out of
it. See, when you said the first four episodes of Series 10, I rewatched The Three Doctors. I was really confused. Oh, dear.
There are many far worse Doctor Who stories you could have rewatched.
That's true. That's true.
Some of them might have been in the first four of Series 10. Let's find out. So for our first round, we are going to talk about Episode 1, Pilot. The Pilot. Sorry, we're getting Danzig already. Wow, that's a record.
It's a really key part of the branding.
You got my back up here, Josh. I don't know what to expect anymore.
Written by Stephen Moffat.
Well, we've all seen it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
And you at home, have you all seen it?
Yeah.
No, not you guys. The people listening to the podcast.
They'll, tweet at us, months later, yeah, that's all it was.
Yeah. Well, one thing we should say is I go out of my way to not read any reviews if I know I'm going to talk about it on the podcast. So we may rave about something or make these amazing observations, because this may already be what everyone in the world has talked about this episode. But just so you know, we're starting from this just our totally own fresh perspective. And I will say, fresh, it's in quotations, our own middle-aged perspectives, we'll say that. Obviously, I think my favorite part of Pilot is the introduction of Bill.
Yeah.
Which to this old school fan feels a lot like that classic series companion relationship with some emotional depth. But after Clara, we see the Doctor being kind of the alpha character, and that you can make the Doctor the 2,000-year-old Time Lord who has a lot to teach, but that doesn't necessarily shortchange or make a companion lesser. And so they even made it implicit in the narrative that it's a professor-student relationship. That I appreciated the most about the entire thing.
Well, so I didn't realize we were going to go through them one at a time, because I had sort of thought about like all of them as a whole. Because, you know, when I was on, that I outed myself as absolutely a fan of the current series, and I love talking about it. I mean, as well as the old one. And also that I'm one of those like glass half full people, so where I think there's a lot of people who are fans who like to sort of pick stuff apart and sort of be cynical about it. I'm always like if you want to literally, I'll spend an hour explaining to somebody why like Attack of the Clones is a really good movie, right? So like I tend to take like contrary perspectives, but I will say I love the characters. I love Capaldi. I love Pearl Mackie. I thought the character was really cool, but just as a kind of preview of my opinion of all four of them together, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that we've seen before a whole bunch of times. Like, I was like, haven't we seen this thing where, like, somebody turns into water and, like, creeps through doors and, like, we're scared of water? And, like, in fact, haven't we seen this twice or something like that in the last...
Dickens wrote a novel about it once.
Yeah. So I think, like, the characters are, like, really cool, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like on this one and... Fast forward when we get to the other ones. There's a couple of them that feel like the concepts are a little bit like recycled. So.
I will agree with you there. There is a quality of like we've been here, done that. And what I think freshens it up for me is, A, I'm just a huge fan of Capaldi. I think anything he does is just, he's captivating to watch him.
They pretty much
do
just
anything.
Set him up to do Capaldi business with like, you know, oh, he just gives lectures, but everyone goes to the class and no one knows what the class is even about. I thought that was kind of amazing.
But so here's a question for you, though, because the other thing I think is like Moffat's now on this thing where he wants to pay homage. Like he's gone back to basically the original type of setting, which is like he's at this school. They even play around with in the last episode where he pretends to be her grandfather, right? Yeah. So he's like definitely on this tip where it's like, I want to go back to like the 60s and essentially the original setting. So I'm just curious because I actually can't decide if I like that or not. Like, I think it's interesting that he's doing it, and there's like, he does it in every episode. He basically ties back to the original pilot episode.
It was interesting that the pilot does seem like we're kind of doing a soft reboot. We're reintroducing a lot of the elements. He even explains what TARDIS stands for, as if anybody needs that explanation at this point. There's a picture of Susan and a picture of River on his desk. So it's kind of a sense that everything is going to start new. But we know that Peter Capaldi's done at the end of this season. So is it new? Is it a continuation of the thing that we've seen before? And going back to your earlier point about haven't we seen Waters of Mars and the rest of these characters, I agree with you. I don't think that there's anything too innovative in the plot of any of these four episodes, spoilers. But I did feel that I just kind of liked everything more than I have recently, because it felt like the handbrake was off. I don't have to deal with the Dr. Clara relationship or the new kind of bumpy characterization of Peter Capaldi that was from two seasons ago. I just, right from the get-go, I thought the relationship between the Doctor and Bill was excellent. I thought both actors are really terrific. It helps, I think, that she's the first openly gay character that we've had, which kind of short-circuits any possibility of the inappropriate hint of romance that has lingered over most of New Who since the May-December, January-December romance, whatever. So,
Given that the Doctor is 2,000 years old, it's kind of like the first minute of January in the last minute of December, the 31st relationship.
In a leap year.
In a leap year. I don't have a lot to add here.
What about Nardole, Kevin? Kevin. Your name's Kevin. Wow. I've known you for about 40 years. Kelvin.
No.
Rebooted. Kevin. Kelvin will now be known as Kevin.
Yeah. Well, Kev.
Yeah. It made me realize, yeah, the doctor kind of needs a valet. it suddenly, like the presence of Nardole made me realize, yeah, the doctor needs someone who just does...
Runs errands. Yeah.
Runs errands, you know, not
house cleaning. He's like...
Yeah, doesn't, you know, like...
Maybe...
Here, you stay in the TARDIS. And then they run out of the TARDIS. Well, do something dumb or
it
whatever.
It just occurred to me, he's Alfred. He's, like, very helpful but somewhat disapproving, you know?
Yeah.
He's Alfred.
Yeah. He's, like, a more comic Alfred who didn't raise the doctors up
for... That we know of!
Moffat is not afraid to retcon things. He might be looking at that early. But I was really reluctant about him being introduced as a semi-regular companion based on the Christmas special, because he seemed just like broad comedy relief.
That seems to be a new series trait to introduce characters in very broad ways like that.
But I think he's used quite well in the new series so far, to the point where now I've reversed, where I'm like, I want more of him. I think the comedy's far more understated.
He's the comic relief character, and then Bill is like... A more serious character. I mean, well, I don't want to say serious, but not like a comic, at its heart, character.
Not like old Nard.
I think there's almost parallels to where they reintroduced Donna, though, where, you know, people initially were like, oh, what, they're bringing that character back? But of course they're bringing them back with a plan to do something with that character and to not be as broad as they were in their original Christmas special appearance.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know where they're going yet, but clearly there's a plan to go somewhere. So, the first episode and all four of them, I've enjoyed what we've seen. Anything I have issues with, I feel like we're not going to really know what to make of it until we've seen the whole season. Because everything that I find, like, I don't know how I feel about that, is all the stuff tied to, you know, we're at this school, there's a vault, the doctor's made an oath to watch over it. We don't know exactly how that works or who the oath was to. And it's all this stuff that, like... Well, retroactively, we're going to feel differently about those elements of these episodes once we know what the heck is going on.
I will say at this point that the vault is probably the most intriguing season arc I think New Series has ever done, just from the get-go. They could ruin it. It could be very dissatisfying, whatever. But, like, I'm actually interested in this vault. Like, the idea of putting the doctor in a position to be responsible. It brings out the best of the character, that he wants to shirk that duty, and you get to see him sneaking off like a... naughty child.
Well, and it's interesting to have a mystery that's a mystery to us, the audience, but not to the doctor. The doctor knows what's going on, clearly. Yeah. We've skipped ahead to the middle of the story and are waiting to have the bits filled in.
It's kind of a callback to the later Seventh Doctor era, in that sense, where the doctor knows what's going on.
Yeah,
and no one else does.
No one does, yeah.
I mean, I actually think I like Bill a lot, and some of that is how she's written, and some of that is the actress. But I think one of the things that makes her feel so refreshing is Clara was such a convoluted character. It's nice that whatever the big arc is, at least at this point, seems to be completely separate from the identity of Bill's character. Bill, I mean, unless we get surprised by something, seems to be a fairly just... She is what she appears to be. She's fun, she's smart, she's engaging. But it's not like, you know... Clara was the season puzzle box, you know, when she was introduced. And then, even once that was no longer the case, she just got more of a convoluted character as the stories accumulated. So I just think it's nice that right now Bill feels like really kind of simple and unentangled as a character, which is very nice.
But something you said made me realize. Actually, the genius of having the two companions is that he's definitely constructed it so that each of them represent a different part of the doctor's personality, right? So the one is the responsible, stay here, guard this thing, like it's your job, like you have to do this. And then the other one is the more youthful, like let's get out and do stuff that's like cool and fun, right? Mm-hmm. So I actually think that sets up a cool kind of just story dynamic, which is like which side does he... He's never really had... Like the character hasn't typically had angels and devils on the shoulder kind of pulling in different directions.
Yeah. And it's nuanced, too, because he kind of projects that onto Bill. She's not, let's go explore the universe. She's a little more hesitant. She doesn't know what she's getting into, but he... recognizes in her a person who would like to do that. Yeah, and right. So kind of puts
plus
it on
plus, he's
her.
Really bored. So, like, so yeah, there's a little bit of that.
He's been there for
projection.
At least 50 years.
Yeah. And also, it's a season arc that isn't just one word. Because usually they just say vault over and over again for four episodes, and that would be a season arc. Like it just
what's
says
the
hybrid.
Vault they keep
talking
about? Yeah, yeah. Have you noticed they keep saying vault?
Like a hybrid.
Yes.
Vault was written on that wall. Yeah.
Whose fault is the vault?
Yeah.
Did you know that character's vault name is more. French for vault?
Did you notice that? What's this vault doing here? I could do something with it.
Yeah, what are you
I think we all kind of agree based on what we've talked about. No one has mentioned the intriguing story about the super intelligent spaceship oil. Like, that was not what was intriguing about this.
Well yeah, right? The primary function of this story was to establish Bill and establish the tone of the series and, like, the Doctor's new reality that he's living in, mm-hmm. and more than, like, its own... It's not really its own self-contained entity so much. Yeah.
Nobody cared about the big eye alien in the 11th hour. It, you know, it's the very simple, straightforward story that lets you do all the character work for a season opener.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we get the description of Peter Capaldi running like a penguin with his arse on fire. And I was like, I love it when Moffat insults his lead. He loves to try to... he figures out what weird physical quirk or something they might be insecure about in their body or appearance, and then he puts that voice into the script.
Already seen gifs of that.
To wrap up, final verdict here, guys. I mean, go down the line, plunger up or plunger down. We didn't even talk about the Daleks, actually. Yeah. That's how.
Or the Mavellan Disco Dance Party.
Oh, you're right. That, for me, was ruined kind of by having the teaser in the... clip show,
well, especially
it
since it was a cameo, there wasn't much more to actually seeing it in the episode. It's like the moment of joy at seeing the Mavellans came when you saw the teaser, not when they showed up in the episode.
So it was a little disappointing.
It's plunger fully up.
Plunger up for bad.
Okay.
My plunger's up. Yeah.
Christian, what about you?
I have to vote. Oh, well, again, I'm an eternal optimist, so I'm going to say up.
I'm saying plunger up.
Plunger way, way up.
Wow, there's... five middle-aged men with their plungers up.
Oh, yeah. I think we have a new name for the podcast.
All right, so that moves us into round two, which is smile.
Smile.
I can't remember who wrote any of this stuff past... Stephen Moffat writing the first episode.
If only there was some electronic database of information.
Or a room full of nerds who could just shout out the writer.
Frank Contrabois.
Thank you.
There we go.
Frank Contrabois.
But who directed it?
Elmer Dinglefritz.
I like Elmer Dinglefritz's work.
Yeah.
Well, his earlier European work.
Like, he's grown.
Yeah, before he went all Hollywood and, like, had to water down his essential themes. And...
like Fritz Lang. We're talking about Doctor Who here.
Yeah. I'm glad he's finally gotten his early split-screen stuff. That was getting derivative and,
That very expressionistic mise-en-scene he kept using.
Yeah. Although, if anyone has picked up the Elmer Dinglefritz Criterion Collection, I highly recommend it.
Digressions.
Guys, do you think we have five more minutes of this bit? Because we can just keep going.
I sure hope so, Josh.
No one want to talk about Smiley?
I will say this about Smile, that the first, like, 30 minutes, I loved to death. It felt like old-school Doctor Who in that... There was a mystery, and they slowly walked around together and figured it out.
Yes.
It felt like Ark in Space.
It felt very Ark in Space-like, yeah.
And it built on the relationship. Yeah. And then it turned into a new Who story in the last, 10 to 15 minutes, and it was really dull, and they just sort of shouted the exposition at each other, and it was just, over.
Exactly. Well, and that was, all of a sudden at the end, I was thinking the same thing, so... Again, not to sound the old days were better, but you had essentially four 20-plus minute episodes to tell a story, right? Mm-hmm. So you could pace it out. And so then on this one, I agree with you, the first half of it felt really, really well paced. Then all of a sudden at the very end, they started introducing all these ideas. This is a new life form that you have to respect as a new life form. Mm-hmm. They've become sentient, and they're you haven't talked anything about this. The only thing you've talked about is the fact that they're triggered off emotions, right? So you're right. There was this sort of explainer, exposition at the end, that if you could have spent another half hour on actually sort of unpacking that, that would have been.
And it almost felt like the people talked fast. It felt like a live recording. Like literally, we're running out of time and they're going to pull the plug. We got to get these lines of dialogue out. Yeah. And it's very exposition heavy. It feels almost like a Big Finish audio. It's not even like no more visual story. Yeah. I don't mean to rip on Big Finish. I love Big Finish, but it's all the action is in exposition.
Yeah, I actually did think the concept of emoji, because I mean, they are. A way that people communicate now, and this idea that in the future, like, that's really all you need. Like, you don't even need words anymore. You just need little faces, right, to explain everything. I thought was a good way. It's a good concept to start with.
Christian, you must be reading my mail, because I'm looking at my notes. I'm like, oh, yeah, Christian's covered all that, so I don't really have much else to say, except that there was a David Bowie reference in it. I'm happy. Hope you're happy, too.
Yes.
Which is always gives me a little bit of joy. Also, I had a link here. I was going to talk about the name of the ship, the Erewhon. Which is the name of a Butler Lytton novel.
Nowhere spelled backwards.
Yes, Nowhere. It's one of those early utopian novels in the 19th century, and it contains part of it that's called The Book of the Machines, and the French theorists Deleuze and Guattari, who I read in college.
Oh, I know them so well.
Unpack it, Pat. Unpack it. Go, man.
But here's the thing. I can't get on the internet, so I can't check my links right now, so that you're just going to have to... That's homework.
Those stories were big influences on the early work of Elmer Digglefritz.
We're going to leave this as an exercise for the reader or the listener, and just assume that I said something very erudite and interesting there. But moving on. Kevin.
Thank you so much. I really liked the main plot twist where they figured out why the robots were acting that way, the grief virus. That they didn't know what to deal with. That I did not see that coming. It was a great twist, I thought, and you know, I thought it was a plausible reason for why helper robots would suddenly get all weird and exterminatory. That's not a word. But
do you remember the just going back on like old internet memes? Do you remember the terrible secret of space? Does anyone remember that? It was like a very old, from like almost like 15 years ago. It was this animated thing. There was a song with these two robots. We're here to protect you from the terrible secret of space. And the whole idea was like these two robots and they're singing, but as the song goes on, you start to realize that the way they're going to protect you is there's one that's like, I am the pusher robot, push humans down the stairs or whatever. And so the whole thing is like, anyway, just look at it. Someone still has it archived on YouTube. It was like an old like Flash movie thing, but it reminds me of that. Like they're like, yes, we're coming from outer space to protect you by shoving you down the stairs. And that's our job. We're the shover robots.
I had this weird idea that they were so desperate to avoid the mistakes of earlier colonization in human history that they actually created their own indigenous people.
See? Now if they'd had another half hour, they could have done that.
And it's like, that's really bizarre and messed up, but that's what happened here.
Part of it that felt, I mean, if it even felt rushed and too convenient to me, I mean, I agree. I like the twist of the robots being confused by grief and having that screw up their programming. It was not only the recognition of them as a new proper life form, but then that they were so conveniently willing to strike this bargain to share their space. Because they made the cute joke about, like, ooh, you know, you're going to pay us to Ching, you know, which was cute, but it's like, why would they care about whatever would be offered? I mean, I thought, like, it would have been just as rational for the robots to not have any interest in making a deal to share their city with these humans that they now don't understand their presence. It felt a little convenient.
Those things always remind me, too, of like when you look at those characters and you're like thinking back to like the guy who designed this robot. And you're like, I'm going to design a robot that's designed to serve every human need. Oh, by the way, it can kill. Because there's definitely going to be a situation where they're going to need to kill in order to make people happy, right?
And like, we certainly don't want to build in a fail-safe or anything that would allow you to shut the system down.
It's just basic robot functionality.
Yeah, it's like, what's a robot that can't kill?
Right? No robot at all.
I did think that it was a very effective design of something that believably was designed to look appealing, but within the context of the story was very creepy and scary. Mm-hmm. I thought they were creepy in the same way that, like, you know, dolls can be creepy or mannequins can be creepy. It's that thing of, It's friendly looking. I'm doing air quotes. but when it's doing something menacing, and it's still that same kind of inhuman sort of happy face, it takes on a real disturbing quality.
And that actually was the kind of thing, because I've done like interface design stuff, and so I'm looking at that going, why would you create a happy face made out of skulls as an interface for this robot? Like, who built that? What designer built that? You know, it'd be funny is like if the thing
it
got
just
mad.
Looks bad.
What if it just had skulls instead of other things? You know, you're like, okay, yeah, sure, sounds good.
All right, so a final verdict on this one: smile or frown, Pat?
Oh, I'm smiling. It's a little death's head smile, but I'm smiling.
His teeth are all little skulls. You can't see the listeners at home.
Yeah. Yep. I'm going to give it this with the caveats that you and I both said, but I give it the smile.
I will smile.
I'm trying not to smile, but I'm going to. I will say this quick, sneak this in. The other thing I really liked about it that overwhelmed the ending is the more development between the Doctor and Bill. We're all used to companions, but if you really were a companion and you didn't know that the Doctor saved people, you would have to figure that out. And so they have that moment in there where she doesn't realize, oh, the Doctor doesn't leave dangerous situations. He stays there to fight them. And I thought that was a great scene. So for that alone, I will say smile.
Yes, I will put it a smile as well. And I like the fact that Bill seems to be asking the questions that no one's ever asked before, but it's the kind of thing that the fans have, like, where is the bathroom? Where does the Doctor sleep? And it's just like, finally, somebody's asking these things. So, yeah, that's great.
All right, then round three, Thin Ice.
No, so you guys, I should start this by saying that I really liked this episode, because from the things that I'm about to say, you might get the impression that I didn't. Okay, so there's a giant angler fish that eats homeless people and poops out rocket fuel.
Okay. That old trope?
Yeah.
This is what we're talking about. Recycled.
Yeah, you saw that in a Wilkie Collins novel.
I can't say I've ever seen that before. You know?
I'm trying to picture Moffat on the other end of that pitch. Okay, come into my office. What do you got? It's a giant anglerfish that poops rocket fuel when it eats homeless children.
This is time-lapse all over
again. You're signed.
It raises obvious questions like, why can't Lord Sutcliffe just use like cows or something? But I mean, I suppose cows have value and street urchins don't. But it still seems a little convoluted for my taste. It's kind of a rerun of The Beast Below, if you remember that early Matt Smith episode. And it also, Kevin, I'm sorry that I even...
There's an L in there!
I hate to even bring this up, but Kill the Moon.
Yeah. I was going to bring it up even if you weren't. So.
Okay. The Doctor gives Bill the choice of whether to free the beast or not, which is always, in Doctor Who, it's a little bit of a false choice, because we know that the Doctor is the moral authority, and it's not going to lead into a holocaust of anglerfish eating fishermen down the Thames. It's probably not. And really, what else are they going to do? Just leave it there? Leave it at the bottom of the river? That's the choice, right? But it's the same choice that Kill the Moon had.
Yeah, a choice that isn't a choice.
It's not a choice.
And he has a kind of absurd line there, given that they're dealing with race and they've had an orphan die, and he's like, do you want your future to be built on suffering? And it's like, too late. What else is it built on? He just went, just the suffering of this one giant fish.
I thought that it was really interesting, as far as it's the most explicit discussion of race that we have ever had in Doctor Who, at least real race, like human beings race. It reruns the conversation that David Tennant had with Martha at the beginning of the Shakespeare Code, where they go back to Elizabethan England, and she's a little worried, like, you know, isn't my skin tone going to be a problem here? And he just kind of poo-poos it. I had to look the exchange up, because at some point Shakespeare says she's a delicious blackamoor lady, an Ethiop girl, a swarth, a queen of Afric. Martha's, I can't believe I'm hearing this. The Doctor says, it's political correctness gone mad, or Martha's from a far-off land, Fredonia. So this is typical Russell T. Davies stuff, where he wants, there's a clear thing that needs to be addressed that he's going to do in a kind of absurdist way. I don't think he wrote it, but it's very typical of his period, and then we're just going to kind of move on from there. But I think that the episode does something very well, which is that Bill is quite right at the beginning, it's like, I'm a black person traveling in time. Like, that sounds terrible. You know, it's like, why would you ever want to go backward in time, at least to the areas that Doctor Who visits, which are white spaces, and she's quite rightly unhappy about the idea. And Capaldi points out that, yes, it was more, it was less white than you're going to see on Downton Abbey, but it's still sort of a thing. And he poo-poos it, and they get along very well throughout the episode until you meet the actual racist Lord Sutcliffe. Yeah.
Lord Racist.
Lord Racist.
And the most satisfying punch thrown in the history of Doctor Who.
Yes.
And what I really liked about it, especially for the Moffat era, is that a little boy died. He really died. He stayed dead. I love
Yay,
dead children.
Children.
You're all monsters.
That actor actually died.
No animals were hurt in the making of this show, but small children. All
no one said
all.
Anything about little Jimmy.
But no, I mean, there are real consequences, and that is nice for once there wasn't a reset magic wand.
I'm with you, and we'll talk about that in Knock Knock, too, the next episode.
For those of you not familiar with our podcast, there is something of a running gag in it about how much I dislike Kill the Moon. and this did seem like a weird parallel to Kill the Moon, where there's this ginormous life form that's apparently just always been on Earth, and no one's ever noticed it. And I, you know, but not quite as absurd as like the moon being an egg.
We're not going to go down there.
No,
right?
No, I'm trying not to
go there.
We had like 8 episodes on this subject.
Yes, but
I can't believe no one's ever noticed that bacon in orbit before.
But I liked how Thin Ice did it in a much more acceptable way. It wasn't so grandiosely outrageous and hurting of the basic laws of physics. You know, I do want to know what the little assistant tiny angler fish were that like whirled around and sucked you through ice. That was really weird to me. Is that just an extension of the big fish somehow?
Babies.
Like, you know,
so
I,
when you have a big fish.
I know how baby fish are made.
When,
yes.
When two big fishes love each other very much.
But yeah, I wish that was explained a little more, because I think that Doctor Who in recent years is getting like more and more hand-wavy, where things just happen, and they just like, well, this will look cool, so we'll do it, but there's no real logic or explanation that comes through to me about why that's there. No.
Although it was fun to see them just eating these alien fish willy-nilly.
Oh yeah, like, well, it's just useful.
I'd eat it.
I thought it was pretty cool that the Doctor gets to put on an old-timey diving suit.
And just in general, that he's back to stealing things. And
yeah! I meant to bring that up, like the Doctor is Thief thing.
Yeah.
I suppose if you were going to like make the Doctor as like a Dungeons & Dragons character, everyone would assume he's a magic user or something. No, he's always been a thief. He stole the TARDIS. He pickpockets people. He does sleight of hand stuff. I mean, he's a thief.
Yeah, which of those episodes was it where he just cops to stealing the TARDIS? It was in one of the first four where she said, "Where did you get this machine?" And he says, "I stole it."
Yeah,
was it in Knock?
I think
was
it's in Thin Ice.
Was it in Thin Ice?
Yeah, there's a whole. Yeah. He's very much bragging about his
ability. The symbolism is really big there.
All right, well, we're running out of time, so final verdict on this: are we? Is it racist punch or dead child? That's our rating system for this one.
Wait, which one's the good one?
Yeah.
When you say racist punch, do you mean punching a racist
can
or a
punch
that
a little further,
racist?
Josh? All right, let's just
have like a KKK.
How about a delicious racist punch?
Yeah.
How about a nice racist punch? Sure.
Living child thumb up, dead child thumb down. I don't know how to get out of this.
Generally, I'm in favor of living children instead of dead children.
Okay, so it'll be.
And I'm also in favor of Thin Ice. Elephant trunk up.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Where's your trunk on this, Kristen?
Yeah, I dig it with a couple of
which will come up when we talk about the next episode.
A couple of reservations.
A couple of caveats. But yeah,
tusk down, maybe.
Yeah, the character stuff is really
it's very uncomfortable. I hate it when that gets down there.
I say punch that racist. It was a good episode.
Good. Right. Okay. Right. I'm with trunk up.
Snork up. I agree with all the criticisms, but I was happy when the episode was done. I mean, I was happy it was over. When the episode ended, I was happy with what I had seen.
By Chris Jones, people.
I'd love to see that at the end of like a movie trailer. I was so glad when it was over.
I loved it. It was much better than Cats. I'm going to see it again and again.
All right. Round four it is. Knock, knock. Yeah. I will say that this is definitely my least favorite of these four. I'll start there. Yep.
So I kind of hinted that I have a question.
Yeah.
So there is a long-running trope in Doctor Who, which is like person who is feeding people to some creature for some purpose, right? And it seemed to me like they literally did two of those in a row because they just got done with an episode where they're feeding people to a monster. So I just thought it was odd that it was like, isn't this the same episode we just saw, only with a bunch of housemates, you know, mixed in with like Big Brother or something like that? Mm-hmm.
It had some credibility issues too. Just the whole, like, I know it's satire with the college students, but it's like, this is just the creepiest guy ever in a gigantic house for no money. And it just.
Then don't go in the tower.
It's so telegraphing everything. And then it did my least favorite new series trope, which is that emotional catharsis as a climax or wrap up. It should be emotionally satisfying for the audience, but not literally. The only thing that ends the episode is two characters' emotional reunion or sacrifice.
Well, just a mother convincing her son to commit suicide with her.
Yeah,
but this is what we were talking
touching.
About. This is the one thing we were talking about with the other episode, where like there was no need to have that twist. There hadn't been any relationship established between them, and then all of a sudden it's like, so here's the relationship between you, only by the way, it's actually not the relationship you think, it's this other relationship. And I was like, I didn't care one way or the other. I've only just figured out that these two have anything to do with each other. And you're already sort of twisting like, surprise, he's actually the son. And I was just kind of like, what? Like, does that matter to the story?
I liked it in theory. It just didn't seem to operate very well.
Yeah, it was
just
like it came up so fast.
Yeah, the idea of a suddenly reversed power dynamic where you are my father, I am your daughter. No, now it turns out that I am your mother and you're my son, and that's how the transition turns.
Right.
So now someone can command the other person, use their emotional leverage to make something else happen. I think it's a very neat concept and could have been done fairly well, but wasn't.
When you say it like that, now I understand why it worked as a pitch. Like, when you're pitching the story, you're like, okay, the whole idea is like this. And then the mother, you know, her emotions kind of take over, and she's more whatever. And it's like, okay, I buy that. But for some reason, it didn't read like that in the scene.
I felt like the pitch was scary knocking. And then they just scrambled to add something else to it to give it depth.
Well, and even like one scene of the landlord character sternly controlling the unseen force in the attic early in the episode would have given more context to the later revelation. But all we just saw is like he's being mysterious and doing the thing with a tuning fork, and we didn't.
Yeah, if your landlord shows up unexpected, lets himself in, and starts banging a tuning fork against your walls, even the dumbest college student.
Well, and in the same way
would be like, wait a second.
Well, and in the same way that I thought the robots from Smile being willing to make a deal to share the planet seemed just this very like convenient, fast resolution. I mean, I think in this story, the fact that the mother character was so quick to decide that both she and the landlord had to go, I mean, like, she could have just as easily decided, I do want to see the world outside this room. I'm going to go exploring. You know, it could have, that turn would have been equally as justifiable from what we had been presented as where they went. Which obviously would have been another, like, two episodes at least. So.
Yeah, and then, as we mentioned, everybody comes back to life.
Yeah, everybody lives ending
there's
again.
There's unclarity on just the details of the story. Like, what happens? They're sucked into the fabric of the house. They're apparently not killed right away because we have them restored. Are the woodlice intelligent creatures? Are they not?
What exactly is the relationship between all these things? Like, right? Who's creating what and running?
Controlling.
And the kid just found them laying around on the roof or something?
Yeah, which is fair. Okay.
In the garden. I don't know why.
Yeah. Is it alien or is it another one of these, like, things, bizarre animals that have been on Earth forever and we just never noticed them?
I think they're Silurian lice.
Okay.
They did kind of have that sort of, like, cybermat kind of look.
They
to
did. I wish it was a
like,
cybermat.
Exactly. I admit I watched this with my guard up a little bit just because, like, oh, God, it's people in a haunted house and the house is killing them. Like, we haven't seen that a million times, you know.
And the fact that everybody was killed, you knew they were coming back to life because that's too brutal.
For these days, yeah.
And so they were so unlikable, too, all of her friends, where it's just like,
really?
Leave them dead. I found
I
them all.
They were nice.
Really?
I
no,
know.
Bring
I mean,
the poor orphan kid
them,
back and let the college students go.
There was,
he was cute.
One thing.
It would have been great if, like, randomly, yeah, the orphan kid came back as well. That's so, like, wow, I'm just batting 1,000 today. All right, go me.
And just in case people don't know, there's the scene where the doctor and Bill split up, and the doctor is paired with this one of the college students in the basement for a while. That character is supposed to be Harry Sullivan's grandson.
What?
What?
Yes. It was mentioned, that was originally in the script, and it got cut on the grounds that no one would know who Harry Sullivan was.
What?
But that's supposed to be Harry Sullivan's grandson.
And given how, again, how it was like the edits were getting so accelerated, like
they
would have had like 5 seconds to tell that part of the
right,
story.
Right, yeah. That's one of the big problems of modern movies, that it's so accelerated all the time that certain things that should be there to give things some kind of resonance are not there.
Yeah, so final verdict here, is it musical, Fur Elisa, or Pop Goes the Weasel? Both of which appeared in here.
Yeah, I gotta say, I think this is a Pop Goes the Weasel and not a Beethoven.
Does Pop Goes the Weasel mean it's crappy?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with that.
I'm still gonna go for Elisa.
Oh, I'm gonna go for Pop Goes the Weasel because it's still vaguely inappropriate. So I'm going to stick with our theme.
I will say Pop Goes the Weasel, but it was a really like rousing rendition of Pop Goes the Weasel.
It's like Pop Goes the Weasel with David Suchet in it. So that because I love David Suchet.
Big brass band. Pop Goes the Weasel.
I've heard some people complaining that they thought David Suchet was wasted in this. Do you feel that was true?
I mean, he gave a great performance.
I think that might be a reason that kind of saved the episode for me was just David Suchet did such a great job being simultaneously the creepy old man and the scared, fearful boy that never grew up. It didn't seem like a weird schizophrenia split personality thing. He made it seem like all
I
one
agree
character.
With you that he's easily the best part of this episode.
Yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm. We could have spent more time.
Agree there. All right, round 5, and this is a little experiment that we're going to try out here, so you'll let us know if it failed.
Oh, yeah.
Pat, set us up.
No, I came up with this. You guys, we're going to try this thing. Sometimes we do improv structures at conventions like this one, and so earlier today we asked you to write down on some index cards one or two words about things that you would like to see in Doctor Who. So what we're about to do is we're going to reveal your suggestions. We're going to go down the line here. We're going to create a 4-part classic Doctor Who pitch. And at the end of it, it will be the greatest show in the galaxy. The opening credits, episode 1, Moore Adric.
I think we have to disqualify that. No one actually wants to see Moore Adric in Doctor Who.
I got it, though, you guys. The TARDIS materializes. We see Matthew Waterhouse after the console has exploded. He says, oh, I guess I'll never know if I was right. He turns around and Peter Capaldi says, come with me if you want to live.
I think it'd be funnier if Peter Capaldi just popped out and said, you are right. And then just got back and just let him die.
Well done.
The gold star to you closes the door and leaves.
Guess what? The doctor went back in time to save Clara, but not.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't really care.
As the episode continues, Christian.
Oh, I'm already regretting sitting right here.
Diverse women roles.
You got Adric.
It's challenging.
Adric was a softball compared to this. Okay, so the doctor. It starts with the doctor, like any good Doctor Who episode. But the twist is, it's a flashback, and the doctor is a young person, and he becomes a companion sidekick to another Time Lord who's a female Time Lord, and then goes on a series of adventures in which his sort of Time Lord mistress that he follows battles primarily other evil female scientists in the same way that he sort of. So it's a sort of like what's the thing they call in comics, the gender flipping.
Rule 34.
What is it called?
No.
Anyway, 63.
63, is that what it's called? Anyway, like so that would be kind of like the idea of like what if he was the sidekick
and
so he followed another time.
And Adric from the point of death is with them for some reason.
Yes. So okay. we've got a complicated setup here, Calvin.
Oh
so
yes.
We have Peter Capaldi. Maybe there's two time frames going on. Mm. There's a young Peter Capaldi who is apprenticed to a diverse another group of women, and then older Peter Capaldi with Adric. So they encounter the trickster.
The trickster.
Is that a character from the new
Sarah Jane?
Oh God, I never saw any of the Sarah Jane episodes.
Let's just go with the Flash villain.
Dark animal. All I was thinking of was the Flash villain. Yeah.
What if they're the same?
They could be the same.
Oh, no.
It doesn't have to be a good pitch, Calvin.
Okay. After defeating one of the diverse women evil scientists who was attempting to like reconfigure Daleks into her personal army, which of course ended in disaster because they're Daleks, duh. suddenly reveals like, ha! You fell for my trap, and does the thing where they pull their face off, and it reveals that it's the trickster, and not actually a diverse female scientist, but
Mark Hamill dressed as a female trickster.
Yes,
yes.
Joshua,
perfectly yes. Logical.
Celestial Toymaker.
And so we find out that this has all been in the Celestial Toymaker's creepy toy room where he likes to play with girl dolls. And he's got Adric and old Peter Capaldi and young Peter Capaldi, and they're all playing with his girl dolls right up until dun dun dun.
Hashtag where's Ray?
Free ribbons. Ribbons, Chris Jones. We need a cleaner here.
At this point, we realize with the two Peter Capaldi doctors and Adric and who else is running around with this group at this place? Is that it?
Some ladies.
There's a lady.
We realize what the Celestial Toymaker's terrible plan is. They are all toys in his toy box, but he's going to repackage them and sell them falsely as mint in box action figures. And his big come on to get people to come and buy is with every purchase, you get a free ribbon.
Stinger cliffhanger. End of episode one. Christian, you're
that
going
was
to
the
show.
End of episode one.
That was episode one.
That was a hell of an action packed first episode.
As we continue through our four-parter, the pace picks up. It becomes increasingly exciting and increasingly fast. Christian, an adipose planet.
The Celestial Toymaker is having distribution problems because all his retail is having their lunch eaten by Amazon. So he knows he needs a new strategy. Dolls are not enough. He needs to find cute little cuddly things that everyone on Earth can go crazy for. So he goes to the adipose planet and starts bagging these babies up in little bags and selling them for $10 a pop at Walmart.
Kelvin, more cowbell.
Get in there. Sell it.
But he's having trouble bagging up the adipose, so he decides to, like, do this marching band thing where he whips out a cowbell and he goes dink, 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 dink on the cowboy. He's like, you know, follow me, adipose, or something. And, like, he manages to lead him. And there's, like, a big, like, parade.
It's the Pied Cowbeller?
The Pied Cowbell.
I want to see Michael Goff doing this.
And they all
get
led into the TARDIS.
Joshua, yes. Ziggy Stardust.
And then Ziggy Starburst shows up. Stardust. No, this is actually
Ziggy
his cousin.
Starburst.
It's his cousin Ziggy Starburst. His younger cousin who's just
who's cherry flavored.
Just learning the ropes.
Juicy, yeah.
Played by Phil Bowie.
Yeah. And he goes into business and it decides that I'm going to do a rock opera version of the original Celestial Toy Maker, and that's what's going to sell these toys, because that was a boring-ass episode, and Christian's never going to get off his ass and do a rock opera, so he's like, let's do that.
Chris Jones, more dinosaurs.
And at this point, he's realizing his whole marketing approach isn't modern enough, isn't hip enough. It's old-fashioned. He's virtually a dinosaur in this market. So he's looking for new ways to get out there. He needs to go transmedia. It needs to be rock opera. It needs to be action figures. It needs to be comic books. It needs to be a TV show. And he's going to invent himself and become we don't know what.
That's cybernetic platypus. It's at this point the viewer realizes that Peter Capaldi and Matthew Waterhouse have clearly been on vacation for the last week because they don't appear in this episode whatsoever. No. So, I will become a cybernetic platypus, says the Celestial Toymaker, as meow, episode 2 ends.
Yes. This was the season the ratings went down, wasn't it? This is actually from J&T's last season.
Series 27. Yeah. Kelvin, the interior TARDIS doors do something.
So, the 12th Doctor goes to Adric and says, well, let's see where we wound up. And they can't open the doors for something. Something is blocking the TARDIS doors.
Joshua, competent companions.
He pushes the TARDIS doors open, and there are just like 5 or 6 competent companions standing right there, and he just breaks Adric's neck.
Chris Jones, Maggie Smith, circa 1965.
And the leader of the competent companions, played, of course, by Maggie Smith, circa 1965, steps forward and says, I've been waiting for you to do that for 35 years.
And the doctor says, chameleon! And as the episode ends, a prototype TARDIS does something.
The group of companions, first of all, they learn to fly the TARDIS correctly. And by the way, while they're at it, they repair the chameleon circuit and they do all the stuff that they're going to go. But then they kind of realize, because they're more competent, that the TARDIS is a piece of crap. So they set out on a mission to Gallifrey to steal a much better one. And so they go back and they find one of the original TARDIS prototypes and steal it.
Episode 3 comes to an end. Where is this going?
The big wrap-up.
We're going to find out.
I just realized I have to resolve all of this.
Yeah. It's going to fall to you, Kevin. Joshua, as the credits come up in episode 4, everything's going to come together. Celestial Toymakers, dead Adric, Maggie Smith as chameleon, mm-hmm. prototypical TARDISes. And 1920s Chicago gangsters.
So the prototype TARDIS lands in 1920s Chicago gangster, like on one of the gangsters, and starts a full-out gang war. Only they've landed, and Daleks are still there from the lame Daleks war. Weren't they in Manhattan in 1920s? No, they were already there.
That was the 1930s, though.
Whatever. Close enough.
There's a whole...
Nobody understands history in Doctor Who.
Chris Jones, doctor stuck in line at the DMV to renew the TARDIS's driver's license.
So, in the middle of all this action, you know, suddenly they realize the doctor's not there, and it's because he's trying to get his license renewed at the DMV. You know, in the 1920s, there's this huge crowd, trouble's breaking out, he realizes he has to get back to help everybody, and he pulls out this weapon, and everyone's like shocked to see the doctor holding what appears to be a gun. He's like, what, haven't you ever thought a Tommy gun could stand to be more sonic? And he blasts the crowd with sound waves and makes his way through the crowd of the DMV, completes his business, and rushes off to help his companions.
Before he does that, he decides to stop off in the 1960s to hang out with his friends Ray and Dave Davies and have a lazy Sunday afternoon hanging out with the chameleon looking like Maggie Smith in 1965 and generally chilling because, I mean, the Celestial Toymaker, we gotta hurry? Come on.
He's a dedicated follower of fashion.
Speaking of which, rock monsters.
Rock
I think
monsters.
Maybe that's rock monsters.
I know. I was. I immediately went to the rock and roll.
Rock monsters.
I know. Monsters of rock.
Can I'm happy with rock lobsters.
But hey, it's your interpretation.
Okay, so the kinks hang with the doctor, and they're like, hey, do you like rock? And the doctor's like, yeah, I like rock. I'll show you guys some good rock. And so he takes them to a rock planet that's full of giant rock monsters who also happen to love rock music. And the Davies become kings. They're
heroes,
worshipped as gods.
Heroes to the Ogre.
Yeah, yeah, worshipped as gods. That's right, yeah.
Well, that's a lot leading into our last 5 minutes of this episode, Kelvin.
I can see what's on the card.
Which oh, no!
Has to incorporate a basket of deplorables.
The doctor takes his TARDIS, orders Maggie Smith Chameleon, circa 1965, to take the prototype TARDIS. They both travel independently to where the Celestial Toymaker is, and they use both TARDISes to set up a time distortion basket around where the Celestial Toymaker is and the adipose, and this causes...
Don't forget the gangsters.
And the gangsters that are in there, and it causes an accelerated form of evolution where they all evolve into deplorable versions of themselves. And then the doctor takes this time field, compresses it, places them into little blister packs. They're all toys now, including the Celestial Toymaker himself.
Ooh,
and he all puts them up into a Walmart in the South someplace. And they all sets them up in the toy section. And he just says, well, someone will buy this and we'll be fine. And
you incorporated Walmart. Actually,
Walmart.
There was a card called Walmart that we did not actually draw, but Kelvin somehow intuited that anyway.
Wow.
And you guys, that was the greatest show in the galaxy.
Thank you,
Kelvin Hatley.
Thank you guys so much for coming. We'd like to thank our guests Christian and Chris.
Yeah.
Thank you. Have a great rest of console room.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And we're saying, get off my world.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for being
here. Very much.
Awesome. You're awesome.
Now let's storm the Marvel panel.
We're gonna.
I doubt they had that much
fun. Speaking of fun.